Good afternoon. So last time we started out by talking about hard drives, which we're talking about because they're sort of what our file systems are based on, even if they're no longer the most popular technology. And we mentioned that hard drives, just they're physical things where we have disks that actually spin and we need to get the physical component that reads from part of the disk to the right location. We have these physical limitations. We have to worry about seek time and rotational latency. This just how long physically does it take us to get to the right part of the disk? And that meant that we'd have these concerns later on when we're thinking about performance, about where do I, put my data? I want to lower that physical movement time. We mentioned that although usually the hard drive keeps things that have close sector numbers together, that the physical media is kind of unreliable. And one of the ways that hard drives deal with this is that the disk controller, without telling the OS, moves data around on the disk to avoid regions of the disk, that have physically become bad, that can no longer store a magnetic signal. Then we talked about solid-state disks. And solid-state disks are providing this hard drive interface, but doing it on top of a very different technology. This flash technology didn't have any moving parts, so that makes it more reliable, but it had some peculiar features. And the big one was this idea of erasure blocks. On a hard drive, we could just overwrite any part of the disk. Yes, we have to pay the cost of getting the head to the right place. With a solid-state disk, if we want to overwrite part of the disk, we need to erase all the data around it first in these relatively big blocks. And worse, we can only do that so many times per block before it starts failing. So we can't do what we're used to on a hard drive, where we overwrite part of the hard drive many, many times. If you think of the FAT, we have this, file allocation table, the beginning of the disk. We're going to overwrite that a whole lot. And on a hard drive, that's fine. On a solid state disk, that wouldn't actually work. So, what the controller for the solid state disk does is it does its own block remapping, where every time we overwrite data, it actually writes it to a new location, where the idea is that we spread out the load among all the erasure blocks and also deal with the fact that we can only, overwrite a whole erasure block at a time, which is relatively big. So we do this to hide these erasure blocks and let our operating system treat this like a faster hard drive. So then we talked about inode-based file systems. So this was the traditional Unix-based file system design, and the big change was we kept all the data about a file. So, except the name, in one place we called an inode. And we had an array of inodes, which we'd store in one place on the disk. And each inode would have sort of our metadata about the file and have some pointers to the blocks of the file. And well, we couldn't always keep all those blocks in the inode because it's fixed size. So instead, we'd have some, after we ran out of these pointers directly to the blocks, we'd have an indirect pointer. So we'd allocate an extra block to store extra block numbers. And sometimes we'd allocate blocks that point to blocks. But we have this extra indirection only for larger files. For smaller files, we fit everything in the inode. And with this scheme, we stored this array of inodes on disk. We still needed to track what blocks were free. In fact, that was kind of grouped together with our tracking of next pointers. Here, we're going to have a separate tracking because we can't put it in the inodes. So we just have a separate free block map. And after we're done with this, rather than like FAT scattering the data between the directory entry and all sorts of parts of the FAT, we basically have one place to look to see the information about a file and update it, And our directory just has an index into the array of inodes rather than having some of the information about the file, but not all of it. So we're going to finish up talking about indirect blocks just very briefly today, and then look at sort of things that we still don't do very well in the XV6 file system, or things we haven't explained. But so before I move on to that, so questions about these things we covered last time. Okay, so I've looked at, we've had the scheme of having direct and indirect blocks. So, you know, the picture from before, we had this picture. You know, so we first used these direct blocks, but then rather than doing some sort of linked list scheme, we have a pointer to an array of more block numbers, then a pointer, if that's not enough, then a pointer to an array of more pointers to arrays of block numbers, and so on. And we can talk about, like, why would we want to do this? You know, why would we do that sort of split scheme? And a key observation is that for small files, we're going to use only direct blocks. And we're not going to allocate any space beyond the inode. And a key reason why this is good is that this is the common case. As we'll learn later, most files are pretty small. So usually we're not going to be allocating indirect blocks. We're not going to deal with it. That doesn't mean they're not important because, you know, I do care that I can read large files and store large files and read them efficiently. But we only have this extra indirection for larger files. And that's the reason why we kind of have this tiered structure where we use direct blocks for small files and not. And the overall result is because we use more and more indirection the larger the file is, you can think of what we have as kind of a slanted tree structure. So we have indirect, we have a 2x indirect that points to more directs that points to blocks. And we fill out the tree sort of starting, you know, we first use this, then this, then this, and we keep going down and end up needing to allocate more and more of these layers of indirection. And what we end up with at any point is sort of a slanted tree, if we like tilted this. So we don't have a linear search to find things. And if we want to think of sort of what the complexity of accessing this is, it's kind of like a tree. It is a tree, it's just a tree. So we get something like a log n time to access things, not linear like we had in the FAT. And we do that sort of regardless of the size of the file, we can build this up. Okay, so questions. So this is where I'm gonna leave off on indirect blocks, but questions about this before we move on. I know this is a point of a lot of confusion. The question is, how does the OS know where it should put the file? You mean put the data? So if you remember our XV6 file system, we had our header, we had a log, which we'll talk about later, we had our free block map, and we had our data, and the OS is going to use this as stores what blocks are free. And this is the blocks for data. And how does the OS is going to choose, I should write this out for real, it's going to choose based on this free block information, you know, some set of blocks in here. And what we've talked about so far, it's correct to choose any subset of those to put any of these blocks where the actual file's data is, and any of these indirect or double indirect or triple indirect blocks it needs to allocate. We'll talk later about maybe ways where we can make specific choices that might be good. Well, kind of briefly. Okay. So the question is arbitrary. So as far as the format, as far as correctness goes, like we can choose anything that's not used. Like, obviously, some choices are better than others. Most notably, we want to keep data for one file close to itself and close to other things will access at the same time. Does that answer your question? Okay. Can you dynamically change the max number of blocks? So which number do you think on this diagram is the max number of blocks? Is it like, are you talking about this length? Like, if we're talking about the sort of maximum size once we have all the indirection, that's sort of fixed when we decide the inode format. If we're talking about the number of entries in here, that's also fixed when we decide that, I don't know. Question, oh, so your question is about, can we change the size of this? So in the scheme I've talked about, this is fixed when we set up the disk and set up the header. So in practice, something you might occasionally want to do is resize a disk. So with a physical disk, this actually doesn't make much sense. I have a hard drive, it's a size. But sometimes we divide up a hard drive into multiple pieces, or we have something like a virtual machine where you want to resize that disk. In that case, if you want to use this kind of file system, then you need to do something kind of ugly, and basically you need to like expand this free block, and that means you need to take all the stuff that was here and move it somewhere. And there are tools for doing that. It's not an easy operation, and also it's kind of scary to run those tools because they're not tested very often, and if they mess up, you'll lose data. But that's what you have to do, is like you have to move, do a whole bunch of rearranging of the data if you want to expand the number of blocks. Does that answer your question? Okay. Okay. So we now know how XV6's file system works, except for this log thing, which we'll talk about later. So, and we can think about, this is probably mostly superior to FAT. We have a more compact way. So more compact table of free blocks. So it should be easier to scan for free blocks. We still haven't answered how to like make good choices about what free blocks to use. It's easier to find a particular part of a file. And if we think of our page cache, this is really useful because when our page cache is asking for part of a file, we're not gonna have like a file descriptor like with a particular location in the file. We're gonna just get me this part of the file now. And we can just use an index and figure it out. So for example, if I ask for, you know, k equals 100, that means, well, it's the, that implies, you know, after the 12 direct blocks. So that means it's block 100 minus 12 of first indirect block. So we can figure out exactly what indices to look at, what places on disk to look at, to get a particular part of the file, unlike with FAT, where we have to traverse a whole linked list to do that. And we also have our file type and size information in one place. And importantly, this means that when we want to modify the file, with FAT, if you want to like make append to the file, you need to modify the FAT to add the stuff you've appended, and also modify the directory entry. Here, we just set one place, that's all we need to do. So it seems generally nice. And you know, it's a good start, but there's gonna be some problems we're gonna talk about with it. And I'm gonna talk about a set of performance issues to start out. So one performance issue we're gonna try to deal with is that we're not keeping our metadata, like our inode data, close to the file data. And the reason for this is because we have sort of our inodes at one part of the disk, and our data, which is most of the disk, and whatever is stored over here is definitely far away from its inode. And that means that when we're accessing that file, we're going to need to read the inode, read the data, and we're going to have a long seek time. And same sort of thing for writing. And we'd really like to keep these close together. And you might say, well, move the inodes. Well, if we move the inodes over here, then the problem occurs again up here. So we need to do something else, and we'll talk about a solution for that that some other file systems do. Another issue is that XV6, when it chooses where to put the file, it made an arbitrary choice. It chooses the first free space. And this seems not so great because it's going to leave files sort of in lots of pieces that might be all throughout the disk, depending on where our free space is. And we'd like to avoid that. So I'm going to talk about a way of kind of avoiding it, but you're probably going to be disappointed because it's not, it sort of works mostly, it doesn't like really guarantee it. Another issue is with our block size. So XV6 has chosen 512 byte blocks. And this means that a relatively large file in XV6's scheme, or if we add more indirect blocks so we can support bigger files, needs a lot of space for metadata, which is both a waste of space and also means that reading those large files is very complicated because we have to get all the block numbers and, you know, turn them into locations on disk and tell the disk controller about it. So that's going to give us overhead both in space and time for larger files. Now, you could say, okay, easy solution, make the blocks bigger. And that is something we could do. And if we do that, we'll run into another problem, which is that small files are going to waste more space. If we make the blocks 1 megabyte, sure, we don't need a lot of space to store a 4 meg file's information, you know, but now our 1 kilobyte file takes up 1 megabyte on disk, most of which we aren't using anything with. So another problem I'll mention, but we won't talk about a solution for, is that directory entries are stored as a list of directory entries, which means that if we have a big directory, it's actually kind of slow. And this is something that real file systems kind of mitigate by storing the directory entries in something like a tree-like data structure, or maybe a hash table-like data structure, but something that's more flexible. So I'm going to first talk about kind of an old solution to these problems from something called the Berkeley Fast File System. And this is an important file system because a lot of other file systems that are used on Unix-like OSs are based on this old file system. So it was originally published by people at Berkeley for the Berkeley Standard Distribution of Unix. And Linux's Extended 2 file system is very heavily based on the FAST file system. So I'm going to start off by talking about sort of two big things that the FAST file system do, which both avoid, one of which is about avoiding those long seek times, that we're somehow going to keep the meta information about files close to the file, and also keep related files and different parts of the same file close to each other on the disk. Then I'm going to talk about a second thing it does to avoid wasting space for tiny files while still allowing us to have block sizes that aren't way too small. So let's talk about first about this issue of trying to keep the inodes close to their data and also trying to make sure that we keep the data for a file all in roughly one place on the disk, that we don't have to seek all over the disk to read one file. And the way that FFS deals with this is that it says, well, you know, we wouldn't have these long seek time problems if we had a smaller disk. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of divide up the entire hard drive into smaller mini disks called block groups. And each of these block groups is going to have its free map, its own little inode array, and its own set of data blocks. So kind of like a mini file system. But these are all going to be really be part of one file system working together. So one thing this means is that we're going to have one common header for everything. And another thing this means is that although we're going to have a separate inode array for each of these block groups, we're not going to insist that inodes in this part and in this inode array all use data blocks here. We'd like that to happen, but sometimes that's not going to be possible. Like sometimes I'm going to have a file which is too big to do that. In that case, it's going to be fine. I'm going to let this inode point to blocks over here or here. Similarly, we're not going to insist that directory entries stored here always point to inodes over here. We're going to allow them to point to inodes anywhere, though we're going to try to prefer that they point to inodes over here. So the way we're going to still support having an inode here point to a block over here is we're going to divide up our block numbers. And we're going to do something similar for the inode numbers. So here I've said each block group I've chosen has 1,000 inodes and 8,000 or so blocks. So I've split up my inode array that I previously had in one place into these pieces. And I've just said, if we're accessing inode number 3,000, if I see that in a directory entry, I know I go to block group 3. That's where inode 3,000 is. If I see in any inode or any indirect block or so on, block number 10,000, I know that's in block group 2, so I go there. So any inode, any, and so on, you know, can access, reference any block, and we can reference any inode from anywhere. We're just going to have a preference that inodes in block group 2, for example, use data blocks in block group 2 when possible. And that's going to be how we're going to try to keep things close together. So it's not going to be a guarantee, but we're going to do it almost all the time. And when it doesn't work out, well, that's okay. It's just a little slow. Now, we have the disk divided up into these block groups. And there's a question of, like, how do I decide what to put in what block group? And the way FFS did this is that they said, well, let's try to keep directories together. So basically, they'll try to assign each block group to a bunch of directories. And if a block group is for a directory, they'll say, let's keep those that directory's files and directory entries and inodes all in that place. So for example, we'll try to put all the files in directory A in block group 2 here, and all the data, all the inodes, and all the directory entries all in this block group. And most of the time, we'll be able to do that. Sometimes there might not be enough room in the block group. If so, that's fine. We just fall back and use space in some other block group. Sort of the most obvious case where you might need to fall back is, let's say we have a really big file. So we'll, you know, we can try to put it in the first block group. If we run out of space there, we'll just switch, put the rest of it in other block groups, and that's going to be fine. And this maybe our big files aren't as close together as they should be, but we still have big chunks of them, so we're going to still not have the worst seek time we could. Okay. So questions about this block group idea? When was it proposed? The paper, I guess I do not have a date written. I assume the 80, early 80s, but I don't actually remember dates very well. It might be earlier, a little around there, a little later, earlier. How are additional blocks for large files chosen? I do not actually know what FFS does for that. I can imagine lots of interesting choices about, like, trying to choose the right next block group, but I don't know what they do. Other questions? So I've told you that when we're allocating a file, you know, based on what directory it's in, we're going to try to put its data in the correct block group. But that gives us the question of, like, where in this data region do I put it? And the solution FFS had is that they just put it in the first three spaces in that block group. You might say, well, this seems as bad as what XV6 is doing, but it's going to be hopefully usually better for two reasons. So one reason is the worst case is, yes, we're splitting up the file into a bunch of pieces, but at least it's all in the same kind of area of disk, so it's not going to be so bad. It's not going to be as if we're like scattering it along the whole disk. The other reason is that FFS had this notion, which was pretty new at the time, that, well, we're not going to use all of our disk. We're going to leave a significant part of it free. And that means that typically we're going to have a bunch of free space at the end of the block group. So it should be usually the case that it works out that when we write large files, we end up getting it mostly contiguous, because first we fill in these little holes, and then we have a big run of free space. Now, to make this work, we need to actually, you know, write the whole file at once, something you might be concerned about. If you're writing this file in little, you know, one piece at a time, maybe it gets interleaved with some other file, and that seems pretty bad. So something that FFS did to make this more likely is that they tried to avoid allocating blocks for a file until when they actually wrote it from their page cache. So basically, when you actually append to the file, but it's still in the page cache, they would not allocate space yet. They would wait until you needed to write it out of the page cache. And at that point, they'd allocate all of the blocks they were writing together. And that the idea is that that made it much more likely that we'd have a bunch of contiguous blocks, or mostly contiguous blocks, for each file. Okay. Now, and this is sort of, as I said, like, usually keeps things, like, kind of contiguous, but I mentioned earlier you might be disappointed, because clearly we could, you know, if you were willing to spend more time figuring out where to put files, we could probably do a little better. But sort of the key thing that the reason why they thought this would work is because they're leaving a bunch of free space, so they know there should be enough slack that they can be kind of sloppy, and there's enough free space that probably they'll find some contiguous space at the end of every block group. It won't all be in the state where it's all just little pieces, holes they need to find. So the overall scheme that FFS used is we try to use the same block group within a directory, and when we make a new subdirectory, we choose a new block group for that subdirectory and for all of the files we put in there. When writing a file, we always try to put it in the same block group as the directory. We use the first free block with the hope that when there are large files, we end up going to the end of the block group where there's some free space and getting a contiguous run most of the time, just because hopefully just people aren't deleting files in a way where they're like creating a 10,000 files and randomly deleting 5,000 of them. They're doing something where we end up with patterns like this, where you have a few little holes in a big space or at the end, or big spaces in the middle that the large file ends up filling. And we wait to allocate blocks, so we allocate them all at once, so they're more likely to be contiguous. So questions about these sort of block group allocation? Some mechanics. Okay, so the next other issue I mentioned that FFS dealt with is the block size being pretty small. So FFS wanted to use bigger blocks, and so that's the obvious solution for it. We have too much space storing block pointers. Make the blocks bigger. You'll have less space because each pointer will point to more stuff. But the problem is that small files, files that don't need a whole block, well, you're going to use a whole block. Sorry. Now, this seems like, you know, maybe not a big concern, because you might say, well, you know, I have my file system to store big files, you know, how bad could the small files be? But if we look at empirical data on what files look like, this is actually a huge issue. So here's a paper from 2000 where they got a bunch of file system workloads from like companies. Sorry, I don't have a more recent one, but hard to come across workloads like this. And they looked at the distribution of file sizes among there. And this is a CDF, so the y-axis is a percentage. The x-axis, which notice a log scale, is a file size. And the way you read this is you can say, okay, right here, this is the line for web. So 20% of the web files were 1K or smaller, and 93% or so were 10K or smaller. Similarly, we can say that this is the line for, say, Sprite, probably, or let's say this is the line for Res, and 65% of the files in the Res set of workload were smaller than 1K, and about a little, 85-86% were smaller than 10K. Hopefully that's reasonably clear. And the big conclusion we get from this is, gosh, half of our files are, and many of these workloads are more than half, are less than 1 kilobyte. So if we wanted to make our block size like 4 kilobytes, well, we're going to be wasting a lot of space because we have so many files which don't need most of that. And this suggests that we really don't want to make the minimum size we can store for a file that small. Now, this isn't to say that the large files aren't important. There's less of them, but they do take up a lot of space. And we're concerned about the performance for reading large files. Like, that's a very important thing for us. So we do have reasons we want bigger block sizes and so on. But we want to do something about these small files. They're actually especially important. We can't kind of shove them off and say, well, let me just make the block size bigger and that's going to be fine. So FFS sort of did this compromise where we kind of have, a normal block size, and we have a special sort of portions of blocks called fragments that we can use for these small files. So the way FFS implemented this is that they said the last block of a file, instead of being a block, we'll let it be what we call a fragment. And we'll divide every block into fragments. And we'll track each fragment, give each fragment its own index, and we'll track separately whether each fragment is free. So we're using a whole bunch more space in the free map, but that's not such a huge deal. And this lets us sort of allocate less than one block for a file, or basically we can take one block and use it to store data for several files all at once. So this is going to add some complexity. Now we need to have, when we allocate blocks, we need to have this sort of distinction between, am I getting only a fragment or a whole block? But now we have a way of having a 4K block size, or we can have, say, a 1K fragment size and avoid wasting 3K of space for half our files, which is literally what we'd be doing in those workloads. Wasting lots of space that we'd really like to use. And there's some overhead to this, but it's very minor compared to the amount of space we're saving by supporting these small files better. Questions about fragments. Now, so I've talked to you about the two big things that FFS did. And there have, of course, been some things since FFS, since it's pretty old. And one of these is dealing with large files. So we made large files not as bad by allowing us to increase our block size more than we would have been comfortable with if we didn't have fragments. But even after we do that, if we think of a large file like, you know, like a movie that's like gigabytes, it still seems like we're in pretty bad shape. That if we have, say, a 1 gigabyte movie and we have 4KB blocks, you know, this means that we have, hundreds of thousands of block numbers. So what does that mean? Well, that means that we need to get all the block numbers to read the file. Read, we need to update for write, for creating. We need to update the free map for all of these, you know, and these two things, like particularly getting all of them to read, seems like pretty bad. And still pretty expensive, and we like to have something where we can handle these large files better. So I'm going to talk about a scheme that some other file systems use. So two examples that use this scheme I'm going to talk about are NTFS, sort of Microsoft's previously default file system, after FAT, and Linux's Extended 4, which was an extension to Extended 2, which was kind of based on FFS. And these have a particular solution we're going to talk about to handle these large files better. So even though we're lowering the number of pointers to just hundreds of thousands instead of millions, it's still, you know, we're still still going to be pretty disappointed about having this large files having still a pretty big list of blocks. And our solution to this is that we're going to store something other than a list of blocks. We're not going to store the whole list. We're going to store it in a compact way. And the observation is that if we did our job right when allocating the file, the sort of block list should be mostly continuous. And what we'd like to do instead of storing, you know, all these numbers is store, oh, we have a range of blocks starting at 1,000 going 100 blocks from there. Something like that instead of a full block list. And we'll call this an extent. So we'll, instead of storing a full block list, we'll store these ranges. And ideally, we'll just have one for file. And that's obviously way more compact. Now, there's a challenge here, though, and that challenge is how do we actually allocate this space, right? Previously, allocating was easy. We found a free block in the block map. We're done. If we want to use these extents, we can't do that. We have to do something smarter and much more intense. So how do we allocate space? So there's a lot of different solutions. So what NTFS has chosen, which is one example, is they scan over the whole block map. They actually keep track of like where the free spaces are and look for the best fit. So they look for the smallest range of free blocks that fits the file. So that's obviously a lot more expensive than looking for the first one that's free. Now, you might say, well, that sounds great, but let's say our disk, we have files here, files here, files here, files here, files here, and let's say what I want to allocate is like this big. We have space for that, you know, maybe this big. We have space for that on this disk, but we can't put it anywhere, any one place. So if we run into a situation like that, we're going to store a list of extents. So store a list of extents. So we'll still try to allocate contiguous chunks, but we'll say that, oh, I couldn't put it all in one place, so your file is here plus here plus here. And we'll store, say, in this case, a list of three extents. And hopefully we can keep that number pretty small. In some bad cases, or if we don't have very good allocation, we might have a pretty long list. Now, a disadvantage of this scheme, in addition to how complicated allocation is that for reading, some types of reading are pretty easy, but if we have a list of extents, actually finding the appropriate block to read we're back to a linear search. We have to go through the entire list. You know, we say, I want something here. I need to go through the list and say, oh, it's not in this one. It's in this one here. And potentially need to go through a big list. That's something that some real implementation of this scheme have ways of avoiding, but it means that, you know, using this in practice can be a bunch more complicated. But the key idea is that good case, we store one range of blocks. Not so good case, we still store ranges of blocks, so we still are saving space, but we're going to have to store a list of them. So questions about how extents work. So in that case, I have a bit of an exercise here. That's a multi-part complex exercise where I'm saying we're using an FFS-like file system, and I'm storing a root directory, has two subdirectories. Each subdirectory contains five files, three of them are 512 bytes, two of them are 4 meg, and I have these sizes here. And my first question is, how many inodes are used? Next question is, how many blocks are used if we have 1 kilobyte fragments? Next question is, how many blocks are used if instead of having these block pointers, we have extents? And compute the minimum for both of these, meaning that, you know, assume that, for example, if we can put multiple block fragments in the same block, we do that. Or if we can use one extent for a file instead of two, that would save space, we do that. You know, just assume the best case, and let's work out all these. Remember, we have to store the subdirectories, which is why I told you about this directory entry size. Okay, and I'll give you a bunch of time to work on this because I know this is not a short exercise or set of exercises. Hopefully you're seeing a poll, and I don't have to fix that. Expecting an answer by now, which is why I was concerned about whether people are seeing the poll. Zero votes. Okay, at least someone sees the poll. I was hoping for a much higher response rate. I'll give you another minute. Hopefully, some of you are just working. Yeah. Finishing up some calculations. Okay, so finish up. Okay, so I know a bunch of you haven't finished. I assume you can work on it while I go over like the questions in order so you can still work on that. And here we go. So let's see what we have or don't have consensus on. So we have absolutely no consensus on how many inodes are used. So let's start with that. So inodes, remember that each file needs an inode. That's the information about each file. So five files, each file, you know, each with inode, plus we need an inode. So we have these two subdirectories, each has five files. Each of those five files needs an inode. The subdirectory needs an inode, and the root directory is going to have an inode. So that's six for each of the two subdirectories, times two for two subdirectories, so that gives us 12, plus one for the root directory, so I got 13. So questions on how I figure that out. So this is, we have an inode array of some fixed size, and for the scenario here, we have 13 of those inodes are in use. Questions about computing the number of inodes? Okay, so then the next part was about how many blocks were used with fragments. Sorry. So the question is, what an inode is. So our inode, do I have a spare backup slide for this? Of course I don't. So an inode has its size, modification time, and other info about the file, as well as pointer to first, in this case 4KB, pointer to second 4KB, pointer third 4KB. So this is for inode, for a file, and then pointer to more pointers, pointer . So this is for a file, so this is a sort of fixed size struct on disk. So each file has this fixed size structure on disk, which has, here I have info about the file, like its size, its modification time, and so on. We have pointers to the beginning of its data, pointers to its data for the beginning. For the beginning of the file, which just give us where is the first 4K, where is the second 4K, or, in this case, 4K because of the block size. We could have a different block size, in which case we point to a different thing. And you might say, an observation you make is, well, if I want to support a really big file, with then this being a fixed size, that's going to be a problem. So what we're going to do to deal with that is we'll have a pointer to more pointers for if we ran out of good pointers in the inode, and then a pointer to pointers to more pointers if that's not good enough. And those were our indirect and double indirect blocks that I showed you earlier. So we have these two parts in our inode. Our first part is this information about the file that's just like size, modification time, owner, and so on. And then we have our information about where the data is, where we have this sort of tree structure where we have first pointers to data, then pointers to pointers to data, pointers to pointers to pointers to data. But all these pointers point to single blocks of either data or pointers. So does that answer your question? So each file and directory has only one inode? Yes. If it's not enough to store the data for the file, we're going to have one of these indirect or double indirect or triple indirect pointers that points to the extra stuff, information we need to find the data for the file. And in this case, iBlock was one of the fields of an actual inode. Yes. Okay, so that's inodes. Yes, and it is, I do want to clarify this because this is a common confusion about, we use multiple inodes for a file or multiple files in one inode. That's not how it works. Each directory, each file, own inode. So then let's talk about blocks with fragments. So first, I'm going to look at each of the types of files. We have 6 512-byte files, 3 in each of the 2 subdirectories, and that's going to use one fragment. You might say, gosh, we can put 2 of those in a fragment. Well, no, we can't, because we don't have any way of writing in our inode hey, this only uses half the first or second half of the fragment. All we can say is it's in this fragment starting at the beginning. So we have no way of indicating to split up the fragment. So each of the six files gonna use one fragment, gonna waste half of it. That's just what we have to do. If we wouldn't want to do that, we need to use smaller fragments, which is gonna add some overhead for tracking more fragments. And the subdirectories, we need to store their directory entries. So we have five directory entries, which is going to be way less than 1 kilobyte. We also need some other directory entries. If you're doing the FAT assignment, you may have noticed like there's a dot dot. So we'll have a few extras, but it's all going to be way less than 1 kilobyte. So each of those subdirectories is going to use one whole fragment. And the root directory similarly, going to use one fragment. So if we add these together, that's 6, 7, 8, 9 fragments. So the best we can do to pack those is we have to use 3 blocks. And those 3 blocks can't be used for anything which needs a whole block. Then we have to worry about the big files. So the 4 meg files, they're going to have 1,024 blocks of actual data. But we don't actually have pointers to all those blocks that fit in the inode. We can fit the first 12 pointers, you know, so we have 12 direct pointers to the first 4 times 12 kilobytes, but for the remaining 4 meg minus 36 kilobytes, we need to use one of those indirect pointers. So we're going to have a pointer to a block that contains the pointers for, you know, indexes 13 through 1024, you know, plus 13. But we're not going to use all of that because this points to, one indirect block can point to up to 4 meg, but we're only going to use the first 4 meg minus 36 kb worth of that space. So what we're going to end up with is we have an inode, we have 12 pointers to blocks. We have a pointer to a block with 1,024 pointers to more blocks, but only 4 minus 12 used of those 1,024. But we still need to allocate these blocks and this block. So overall, that gives us the blocks for the data, these indirect blocks, the 4 of them, 3 blocks for the fragments, and that gives us 4,103 blocks. So questions on how I got this? This is 12, this is 1,024 minus 12. Okay, so doesn't seem to be a question. So let's look at this with extents. And a key thing for this extents question, I told you to ignore, we aren't doing fragments. And this means that we have a bunch of small files, so we're going to use more space for them now, since we don't have fragments. So each of the 6 512-byte files, we don't have fragments anymore, it's going to use a single 4K block. We're going to store that, if we store that with an extent, which is what the question was proposing, we'd store, you know, block number, size equals 1. You just say, store an extent that says it's a 1 block extent. Same thing is going to be true for the subdirectories and the root directory, which means now we have 6 blocks, 6 right? Oh yeah, 6 blocks for small files, 3 blocks for just the whole directory entries, plus our 4 meg files, each of the, sorry, four 4 meg files uses 1024. Let's do this correctly. Sorry, I edited this question, so that's why some of the numbers are off, but we have 4096 data blocks. We don't have the indirect blocks anymore, because if they're contiguous, we can store the whole all the information in the inode as an extent, saying starts at this location, goes for 1024 blocks. That's all we need. So in our best case, everything's contiguous here. Everything fits in the inode. We don't need an extra block to store pointers. And we end up with 4,105 blocks. So we have more blocks, but it's because we don't have fragments. Now, something like extended 4 or NTFS sort of combines both of these approaches. So we'll have both fragments and extents. So they'll do better than this. In this case, they'll get our savings from fragments and their savings from extents together, and we'll use less space. Okay. So questions about how I figure this out for extents. Was this the... Okay, so our next topic in our remaining time is going to be about reliability in file systems. And we're going to be mostly concerned about what happens after a crash. So there are other types of reliability that we could be concerned about. We're going to kind of ignore them. They're things we can do. We're not going to have time to talk about them most likely this semester. And when a crash happens, we want to think about, well, what does that mean for the hard drive? And the way hard drives typically work is that they are atomic in a sense, that when we do a hard drive write, either we overwrote the sector or we didn't. And hard drives can do this physically because they store typically a checksum for each sector. So if the write's interrupted while we're writing it, the checksum will mismatch and the hard drive will be able to tell us, hey, I don't have that data. And typically, when the hard drive init fails, we'll get whole disk sectors written, so you won't, and that's what will happen. But while this like seems kind of useful, that you know we don't have to worry about only writing half a sector, this doesn't actually yield a case where we're going to end up with our file system in a good state. So even assuming that we don't get a read error, common case, sector written or not, written fully or not, fully or not written at all. So that's the common case, when the hard drive loses power in the right way, we'll not be in the middle of writing a sector, or we'll finish up writing a sector with a capacitor or something. So then we have the question of, like, is our file system in a consistent state? And this is the primary form of reliability we're going to talk about. And the concerns are, like, are we going to know what blocks are free? Because something that we're doing is that we have the data about any even one file scattered in a whole bunch of places on the disk. So it doesn't help us that one sector is written atomically, because we have to update multiple parts of the disk. So that's the reliability topic we're going to spend most of our time on. I'm not going to talk about two other very important reliability topics very much. One is like dealing with what if the storage like fails? How do we deal with that? There are solutions. We're going to kind of not really talk about them. And also like dealing with mistakes. So there are things we can do. We're going to talk about this problem of reliability in the sense of, are we in a consistent state? And to motivate this, I'm going to give you some examples of, like, how could we get in trouble based on this idea of an inconsistent state. So we have a crash. Our hard drive helpfully, like, makes sure that we've either written something or we haven't. You don't have to worry about like having half written a sector. Why are we still in trouble? And to do this, let's think of a simple operation of moving a file from one directory to another on, say, XP6's file system. So what we're going to do for this is we're going to write a new directory entry and overwrite the old one to mark it as free. And these are two separate updates to different parts of the disk. And this means that when we have a crash, one of the two will happen potentially, and not both, if we crash in the middle of the operation. And let's say we do A, then B. So if we do A before B, and then the crash happens right after we do A, we like lose power or something, then we have an extra pointer to the file. And this is actually a big problem. Let's say I remove the old directory entry. Well, then we're going to say, oh, you're removing that file. Let me clear that off the disk for you, and we'll free the file. Then when I try to use the new directory entry, suddenly the file's not there. So that would be really bad. We want to make sure that we don't let that happen. And you might say, well, this was because you did A then B. Let's do it the other way around. And you'll find out that that's way worse. So here, if we did A then B, at the least, we still could access the file. If we do B then A, and then a crash happens after B, the file just disappeared. We were moving it from one directory to another. Now it's not anywhere. So we don't want to do that either. So both of these options are bad, and we're going to want to do something else. And this is kind of the simplest case. If we think about other common operations on our file system, we have like more scenarios to worry about. So for example, if we're creating a new file and putting some data in it, we want to mark the space for its blocks. We want to write the inode with pointers to those blocks. We want to write a directory entry that points to the inode. And all of our options are going to kind of have problems. So if we mark the blocks as free before we do any of this other stuff, and we have a crash, we reboot, now those blocks are marked as not free, and we'll never allocate them to a file. So we've lost space on our disk that we'll never be able to reclaim. If we write the inode for the file before we update the list of free blocks or the directory entry, we have an inode we can't use because it's not free, and we'll never be able to use that part of the inode again, so we'll be wasting space on the disk. If we do C first, now we have a crash, now we have a directory entry that points to junk, and when we try to access that file, something really strange is going to happen. Like we're going to get some junk that was previously on the disk, who knows what's going to look like. So all these scenarios are pretty bad. And what we really want is we want the whole operation to be like any of the particular parts where we're going to either update the whole thing or not. Just like updating a single sector on the disk, we want it to happen all or not. And we want to make the file system updates work that way. So our trick to make this happen is going to be that we're going to rearrange our file system so updating just one sector does the whole operation. And you might say, gosh, that's going to require like tons of changes. So we're going to kind of bolt this on. So we're going to use our same way of organizing the file, but we're going to use an extra data structure to make sure this ordering property, you know, that one update makes it happen, works. And that's the extra structure is going to be what XV6 calls its lock. And as part of this, we're going to have a concept of a transaction. So a transaction that I'm using is a bunch of updates that happen all at once. So the way we're going to do this is that there's one update that means the transaction does what we call committing. If an update is done, we're going to ensure that it's going to be as if the whole transaction happened. If it's not done, it's going to not happen. And there's no in between. So if that update's there, the change happened. If not, it didn't. And we're going to do this with a log, We're going to do this what I'll call a redo log, and we'll see why it's called a redo log later. And the way this is going to work is when we want to, say, write a file, we're not going to actually update the parts of the disk here, here, and here, where we're going to say, write a directory entry, update an inode, write the file's data. Instead, we're going to write down the things we intend to do to a log first. So we're going to say, here's an operation. It involves updating this part of a directory, this part of the data for a new file, this inode, this free part of the list of free blocks. We're just going to write down everything about the operation first, before we actually change anything on the disk. Then we're going to do our commit operation. We're going to write down, yes, this will definitely happen. And you might say, gosh, why is that okay? But you're just saying, this is definitely going to happen, but you haven't actually edited the inode. You haven't actually written the file's data to the place where it's supposed to be. So our mechanism is going to be that we're going to check this log later, for example, after we reboot, and redo all these operations just in case they weren't actually done. So, you know, we hope that usually we'll actually just do these operations and we don't have to worry, but just in case, we'll redo everything once we've seen this commit on reboot. Now, in our normal operation, we're not rebooting, we don't have a crash. You know, we're going to, you know, keep using this log, so we'll have some other operations which will also update different parts of the disk, and we'll write these all through the log, and over time, we need to, like, stop using this log, right? This log is only so big, we want to put lots of stuff on the disk, so we're going to apply the updates from the log to the disk over time. And eventually, we'll do, say, this whole update here. And when that happens, we'll just free up that space in the log and overwrite it with something else. So if we didn't do that, like, we'd run out of space. So we're eventually going to do the operation. And when we do, we can free up the space in the log. Okay. So let's look at sort of how this works systematically. So the key insight is that once we've written this commit record, we're committing that, yes, we're going to make this operation happen. No, it hasn't happened yet, but we're going to make it happen. So the way that works is that here are our steps, you know, normally. So normally we're going to write the step things we want to do to the log, write a commit message, and then actually do the updates, then reclaim the space. So to see how this solves the problem, which is your question, let's look at what happens if we have a crash in any particular place. So let's say we have a crash before we actually write the commit record. In that case, nothing happened. So we don't have a partially created file, we haven't allocated blocks, no problem. Let's say we have a crash before we reclaim the space in the log, but after we start doing the update. In that case, we have a promise here that we're going to redo the operations. So notice here that we don't reclaim the space in the log until after all the updates we wrote to the log are actually done. And so that way, if we have a crash after we reclaim the space, you know, that's not, the data's already written, it's not a problem. We have a crash while we're actually doing the updates. We're going to redo these updates again. We might have some redundant updates, but that's fine. So our, what I call recovery operation, this is our reboot operation, basically, is going to be, we read the log. If it has a commit, we redo it. If it doesn't have a commit, we ignore it. And after we've actually done the operation, we can reclaim space in the log. So you have a question, how do we ensure that writing to the log is atomic? So the reason why we don't have to worry about it being atomic is that this is going to be one sector, this commit. And we know writing individual sectors are atomic. And that's going to be, and that's why we know that writing the important part of the log is atomic. Writing this stuff, we don't care if it's atomic, as long as we make sure we wait until that's all written before you write the commit. So hopefully that answers your question about atomic. And your question, second question, if there are 100 updates and a crash occurs at 99, we will perform the first 99 updates again? Yes. Because we aren't tracking which ones we've done. And this means there's a trade-off for how much stuff do you put between this begin and this commit. You know, if you put more stuff, recovery is more expensive. If you put less stuff, you have more, recovery is more expensive, but you have more flexibility as far as when you actually do the updates. Okay, so I answer your questions. So question, what if you try to train so many things in a single log entry that exceeds the space in the log? So this is something you need, that file systems need to ensure at design time. So for example, XV6 uses a log, and the way it does this is it knows the maximum number of log entries it needs to write, and log entries represent one sector at a time being changed for any operation, and it makes sure that number is free before it allows the operation to start. And other file systems need to do something like that. So you need to structure your stuff into stuff you do in the log such that you know that you aren't gonna have a problem of trying to do more than you can fit in the log. Does that answer your question? So I'm going to finish up. So something to note here is that to make this work, all the things we write in this log need to be things we can redo. And that just means we need to format the operations like set something, not like add to something. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. Next time we'll finish up talking about redo logging and go on to talk a bit about distributed systems.